WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's been a full century since the event that triggered what the world once called the war to end all wars. On June 28, 1914, the heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, was gunned down on the streets of Sarajevo. World War I hastened the collapse of old powers and saw the rise of new ones. Current State's Kevin Lavery is here with more. Kevin?
Hello, Mark. This is a fascinating period in history. That famous assassination set in motion 4 years of conflict that saw the start of mechanized warfare, chemical weapons, and the rise of communism. I talked with MSU historian Roger Rosentrater about the First World War, and we started with a short biography of Franz Ferdinand.
Well, he is the successor to the 84-year-old emperor of the Austrian Empire, Austrian-Hungarian Empire. He is a nephew of the emperor, and the line of succession was not as particularly good. Matter of fact, the Archduke Francis Ferdinand wasn't really well-liked in the empire. He had married beneath his station as a result. So even though he is a successor, he wasn't really, understandably, apparently, all that well-loved or respected.
What really was the Austro-Hungarian Empire? And there was another big empire just off to the east, the Ottoman Empire. So the map was very different a century ago.
The map was completely different. If you looked at that, the countries of Romania, Hungary, Croatia, Austria, Czechoslovakia, etc., all part of this really diverse and very unstable and weak empire. The Serbians, in particular, were angry at the Austro-Hungarian Empire, partly because a few years before the outbreak of this war, the Austro-Hungarian Empire had absorbed Bosnia and Herzegovina. And as a result, we come to June 28th.
Good segue. June 28th, 1914, Franz Ferdinand is in Sarajevo, which today is now Bosnia-Herzegovina. Before that, it was Yugoslavia. And he's in a motorcade. First of all, there is an attempt on his life, but it fails.
Right. Actually, he knew going into Sarajevo that he might, you know, run into some problems, but he didn't. There was really no security. Nobody worried too much about that. Matter of fact, even the car was an open-top vehicle, as it turns out, and he is riding in this motorcade, and there are several Serbian nationalists. Matter of fact, one historian recently equated him to the terrorists of 9/11. Simply saying that these were teenagers who were committed to, they were Serbian teenagers committed to die for the Serbian independence cause. Well, it's a little bit unclear if the Serbian government was involved or not, but as it turns out, the Austro-Hungarian Empire chose to accuse them, even if they were or weren't. But nevertheless, on June 28th, the Archduke and his wife in this open car, as you say, arrived in Sarajevo. Again, the visit was well published. And then these assassins, which were in a group called the Black Hand, there were several of them. And one of them threw a bomb. And that particular bomb was headed towards the Archduke's car. The driver saw the bomb. He swerved. Francis Ferdinand was able to deflect it with his arm, apparently. Then it exploded behind the car, injuring several aides and onlookers. That 19-year-old bomb thrower took a cyanide pill and jumped into the river. His suicide effort failed, as it turns out. He was hauled out of the river and apparently nearly lynched. Did survive that experience.
Oh, but he had cyanide in his mouth. Not a pleasant way to be pulled out of a river.
The Archduke then went on to his destination, but then later in the day, and this is where it all unfortunately unfolds for him, decided to check on those who had been injured in the earlier explosion. His driver took a wrong turn, and when he turned around, there was another Serbian assassin among this group of the Black Hand who was simply standing there.
Gavrilo Princip.
Thank you for pronouncing that. He stepped on the car's running boards. He fired just 2 shots. One struck the Archduke, the other struck the wife, and they both died almost instantaneously.
His assassination, Roger, is viewed as the most immediate cause of the First World War, but certainly there were many others. That was maybe the linchpin. Was war inevitable? It sounds like there was political unrest in the empire and that was the course the continent was taking anyway.
It's a great question because by the summer of 1914, is my understanding that Europe was really kind of on a powder keg, as it turns out. There had been a century of relative peace in Europe, but for a variety of reasons, according to historians who know more about this than I do, things like, for example, in that century, the growth of the population in Europe from 50 million to almost 300 million. There is the Industrial Revolution, which is results in a lot of manufacturing, obviously, but there's still a fair number of people living in misery. The result is that you see a growth of a lot of doctrines, things like communism, socialism, anarchism. Then you add to that, among the greatest, nationalism, which and then militarism, all of which, again, prepares us for this result in the summer of 1914. I mean, Europe is really ready to explode. One of the things we've not mentioned is how warfare had changed, and yet the strategies really hadn't, particularly things like the machine gun. Now, the European observers had seen the machine gun in use in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905, and maybe this is in keeping with the way these things work. They said, well, it shot down a lot of Japanese, but it wouldn't shoot down Europeans if we go to war. So they again missed that notion that the machine gun was going to play an enormous role. Barbed wire, which was a Western American invention for cattle, as you well know, is considered among the most important devices that, you know, impacts the soldiers' survival on the Western Front, artillery developments and the like. And all of that then contributes. And one of the amazing statistics that when we talk about these armies is that at the outbreak of World War I, with the mobilization of the French and Germans, they each mobilized armies of 4 million men. Now, the United States at that time is a world power as well. Our army was a paltry 100,000 men. Part of the reason that when we entered the war in summer of 1917, the Germans were relatively confident it would be too impossible for the Americans to actually show up and make a difference. They were wrong.
I'm thinking about General Blackjack Pershing, the Supreme Commander of the Allied Powers, American general from Missouri, who arrives in France, and his famous quote is, "Lafayette, nous sommes arrivés."
Well, you did a very nice job of that. And actually, it was an aide that said that, not Pershing, as it turns out.
That's usually how it happens. Usually yes, it's the flunky off to the side, yeah. But the top guy gets the credit.
The top guy gets the credit. Pershing is a fascinating character in his own right. By seniority standpoint, should not have been elevated to command the American Expeditionary Force. But what he really is adamant about, and this sometimes gets lost in the shuffle about American arrival in World War I, is the English and the French simply wanted us to send troops. Matter of fact, they said, don't even send generals, you know, just send captains and from below, and we'll put these guys in our army and then we'll win, all right? Pershing was insistent that what was then known as amalgamation would not take place, that the Americans would fight under the American flag. And as a result, by the time the Americans got around to really contributing on the battlefront, it was months and months later. But he was insistent there would be an American flag. Matter of fact, even the Europeans said, or the British and the French said, just leave your flags home. You know, and it was like, no, it's not going to be that way. And Pershing is really the guy, more than anyone, who simply said, no, it's not going to be that way.
As with every war, some things remain for a long time afterwards and some things don't. The League of Nations that Woodrow Wilson so adamantly fought for eventually became the United Nations, an institution we still have today. Communism came into Eastern Europe. Sarajevo became part of the state of Yugoslavia, which eventually disintegrated into ethnic civil war in the early 1990s. Any thoughts or observations on the legacy, the ghosts of World War I in that region of the world, and why we are still seeing today, 100 years later, the remnants of that era of violence and political strife in the Balkans?
My sense is that there's stability, more stability there now than in recent years. I don't know if that's untrue or not. I mean, I certainly hope so, since my son is planning to visit Croatia in a few weeks. The map has changed, and maybe what we should think is that the map will change again. It's hard to imagine. I mean, Yugoslavia seemed like a stable, growing country, and it's gone, right? I mean, how long was Yugoslavia there? Even Czechoslovakia, which is now divided, correct? It's kind of hard to imagine that there would be more changes.
It's often said that people who don't learn from the past are doomed to repeat it. Almost 50 years after the start of World War I, we get to the early 1960s, the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. President John Kennedy was reading up on World War I when things were heating up in Cuba.
Yeah, maybe one of the legacies of this whole period is brought to us by historian Barbara Tuchman, who published Guns of August in the early 60s. It ultimately would win the Pulitzer Prize. President Kennedy was reading Guns of August, which again brings us to the events of World War I, the beginning of World War I, as the Cuban Missile Crisis was evolving. And again, if you know anything about the Cuban Missile Crisis, the world was spared a nuclear holocaust between the United States and Russia. Again, President Kennedy's military advisors suggested bombing Cuba. He hesitated with that idea and obviously didn't carry it through. And it urged his staff, as well as Army generals, to read Guns of August. So maybe some people did learn from the past.
Let's hope so. Roger Rosentrater is a professor of history at Michigan State University. Roger, great talking to you again.
Right. Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you. For Current State, I'm Kevin Labrie.